Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Kelly Jean Kelly, Jonathan Evans, and Brian Lynn. But first, this report with help from Katie Weaver. The hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico in 2017 destroyed most of the island's forest cover. The storms may have given scientists ideas about how the world will react to climate change and increasingly severe weather. Puerto Rico's El Yunque is the only tropical rainforest under the direction of the United States Forest Service. Researchers there are running controlled studies on how plants react to higher temperatures combined with severe weather, starting with Hurricane Maria. Not far away, another group of researchers is looking at how hurricanes affect the forest environment. Forest Service researcher Tana Wood leads a team testing how plants themselves react to higher temperatures. The 2017 hurricane season, with Maria following another storm, Hurricane Irma, has given researchers a chance to see how storms affect the recovery of struggling ecosystems. This is a concern on Caribbean islands, where scientists say rising temperatures could lead to more intense storms. On a recent trip to the Forest Service Research Center, Wood moved through thick plant life and plant leaves the size of laptop computers. She made her way to three areas surrounded by infrared panels. The devices raise the air and soil temperature by about 4 degrees Celsius.
The plants around the research center were shorter and had more of a brown color than the three unheated control areas. The warmed areas operate on 480 volts of electricity. The power lines are separated from the ground, but the scientists wear special footwear to avoid getting shocked in case of an accident. Nearby, scientist Rob Tunnison put what looked like a small mirror around a dark green plant leaf. He spent 30 minutes to an hour working on each leaf. Wood said they are looking at how soils react and temperatures affect natural processes. One example is photosynthesis, the process through which plants turn sunlight into energy while taking in carbon dioxide and releasing that gas and oxygen into the atmosphere. The researchers are also studying nutrients and microorganisms in the warmed areas. They freeze some of the nutrients and organisms and send them to a laboratory in California for examination. Knowledge about plants and soils in tropical areas could eventually be used in models to identify how larger ecosystems react to changes. Wood added that researchers are able to look at the possibility for tropical plants and soils to react to warmer conditions over time.
Tropical forests are important in recovering and reusing carbon dioxide, one of the gases that studies have linked to slowly rising temperatures in Earth's atmosphere. And such forests store about a third of the world's carbon, Wood said. They also help produce rainfall across the world by releasing water vapor, which in turn creates clouds. Anything that happens in these systems can have an effect on the world's climate, she said. In February, U.S., British, and international climate agencies reported that 2018 was the fourth warmest year on record. Worldwide production of heat-trapping carbon dioxide saw its largest increase in 7 years. In all, carbon dioxide emissions worldwide have increased 55% in the past 20 years. And the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reports that Earth has warmed on average about 2/3 of a degree Celsius. British weather experts noted in February that the world could set record-breaking temperatures over the next 5 years. Scientists expect the world will produce 37.1 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide this year. Studies from the Global Carbon Project show that is up from 36.2 billion metric tons produced in 2018. Kim Cobb is a climate scientist at the Georgia Institute of Technology. She was not involved in the experiments at El Yunque. Cobb said she did not know of any other long-term warming experiments in tropical rainforests. And what will happen at the U.S. Forest Service's site is unclear. It's not a system that we can model extremely well today, let alone under climate change scenarios, Cobb said. But there is little doubt that these kinds of long-term monitoring sites are extremely valuable in our understanding of the water and carbon cycle and how they might change with climate change.
The $3 million project is now in its fourth year. Wood said she hopes it will continue as long as possible. Scientists halted the project for a year after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico on September 20, 2017. That way, they could separate the effect of warming from the effect of the storm, which caused more than $100 billion in damage. Not far from Wood's experiment, scientists are looking at how hurricanes affect the tropical forest. They began by cutting away the highest leaves above parts of the forest to recreate the effects of a storm. They paid workers to cut tree branches and spread them across the forest floor. That helped them study how light and water move through the changed ecosystem and the effect that fallen trees have on soil microbes. They also are measuring cloud base heights to get a sense of how changes could affect rainfall. Maria suddenly gave them a real-life test. It poses a lot of challenges, but a lot of opportunities to move the science forward, said Grisel Gonzalez, a project leader. The experiments are expected to continue for several years. That is, unless new storms move into the Caribbean. Another Atlantic Ocean hurricane season starts June 1st. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Pete Musto.
American homes are a lot like America. They are a mix of designs from many countries, all combined together. For example, a visitor to a neighborhood in the United States might see several kinds of colonial houses. Workers began building these houses in the 1600s, when Britain ruled the area. Colonial houses are often box-shaped, two-story houses. They have a front door in the middle and 5 or 7 windows. Both sides of the house are usually the same. Their original design came from ancient Roman and Greek buildings. But over time, Americans added design elements from the architectural styles of other countries. One modern-day colonial home can have a tall, French-style roof, like the Louvre Museum in Paris. Another can have narrow Greek columns near the front door, like the U.S. White House. Another can have long pieces of wood on the outside, like some houses in England during the Middle Ages. Or the same house can have all three. Jackie Craven is a reporter who writes about architecture. She told VOA over email, "Our homes, like our people, draw from many sources." The style of American homes also show what was happening in the country at the time they were built. In the 1800s, the U.S. was growing economically. Workers learned how to make many copies of the same thing quickly, for not very much money. One result is that a number of Americans could pay for the building of large, complex houses. These are called Victorians, after Queen Victoria, who ruled Britain from 1837 to 1901. Victorian houses follow Queen Victoria's romantic image. They are usually three stories tall and asymmetrical. In other words, the sides are not the same in size or shape. One side may have large windows. Another may have a porch. One side may also be tall and rounded. Victorians also have detailed wood cutouts for visual appeal. At first, Victorians were painted in a mix of earthy colors, like browns, greens, and dark orange. In later years, bright pinks, blues, and yellows became popular combinations. Some observers compare Victorian houses to doll houses, gingerbread houses, or even wedding cakes. They look fancy, but they are modest in relation to some houses that came later. At the end of the 1800s, the Industrial Revolution made steel part of the American environment. Steel helped build railroads and skyscrapers. It also helped make a few American businessmen very wealthy. Some built extremely large mansions that looked more like European castles than family homes. They mixed old Italian, French, and Roman Empire building traditions that aimed to show how powerful and rich the owners were. Inside, the mansions had huge stairways and dining rooms big enough for 100 people. But by the beginning of the 1900s, some people were rejecting shows of wealth by powerful people. And many Americans needed housing that was far less costly, especially during the economic depression of the 1930s. So houses became simpler and smaller. One company, called Sears, made house-building kits you could order from a catalog. The business sent you the parts and the plans for the house. Then you and a few friends built it yourself. The houses lasted, too. About 70% of Sears kit houses are still standing. During the same years that Sears was mailing housing kits, an architect named Frank Lloyd Wright was creating a new kind of American house. Wright did not want to use European ideas. He believed American houses should fit into the nature around them. Some of his most famous houses are long and low, with clean lines and a simple style. The roof hangs far over and beyond the walls, so the area outside feels more connected to the structure. Inside, the rooms are all connected. Wright designed more than 1,000 houses in his life. His influence can be seen in a huge number of American homes built in the 20th century. They are especially common in neighborhoods just outside of cities, called suburbs. For example, the ranch house on the 1960s and 70s television show, The Brady Bunch, was influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright. Susan Piedmont Palladino is an architect and the director of Virginia Tech's Washington Alexandria Architecture Center. She calls the history of American homes an all-you-can-eat buffet. In other words, Americans have many home styles to choose from. We can borrow anybody's style of architecture, and I'm not sure that's the attitude in other countries around the world, she says. And Piedmont Palladino says, American homes are different in another way. She observes that most American homes are for just one family, one set of parents and their children. The single-family house, she says, dominates American neighborhoods. She also notes that as American families are getting smaller, American houses are getting bigger. For example, in the late 1900s, some Americans built large houses again to show their wealth and power. But these houses are not as unique or beautiful as the mansions of the late 1800s. Many of them look similar to each other. They are known in a negative way as McMansions. Mansions that are as common and quickly made as the food at a McDonald's fast food restaurant. Piedmont Palladino says, in the future, she would like to see American houses move a different direction. She hopes owners and builders will seek designs that are friendly to the environment and use resources wisely. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
For hundreds of years, African women have been important to the peace and security of the continent. In the 17th century, a group of female soldiers known as the Women Warriors of Dahomey defended their homeland against invaders in what is now the country of Benin. Eritrean women fought alongside their men during Eritrea's 30-year fight for independence in the 20th century. The women also healed the wounded and repaired equipment for return to the battlefield. African women, however, continue to face harassment and discrimination at all levels of military service. And when the conflicts ease up, they often receive less recognition than male armed forces members. In South Africa, changes in gender policy have led to a slow improvement in the years since the end of racial separation. Women now make up nearly one-fourth of the country's full-time armed forces. But difficulties remain. The problems are documented in research by the African Peacekeeping Network and the National Research Foundation of South Africa. Its study found that women are still considered less capable than men in the armed forces. Women are not permitted to serve in battle, and weapon training was limited to self-defense. The higher or better paid jobs were given to men, not women. The report said this had more to do with the conservative attitudes of broader society towards women than the military itself. In some African countries, women serve in smaller numbers in the armed forces. In others, women are blocked from some duties or barred from joining the military altogether. That has not prevented some women from rising to the highest positions in their country's militaries. For example, Mosiviwe Mapisa Nkakula is the longest-serving female defense minister on the African continent. She has been South Africa's defense minister since 2012. Kenya's defense minister, Rachel Omamo, has served since 2013. In the past 2 years, Kenya and Uganda appointed their first female major generals. And Marie Noelle Koyera has led the Central African Republic's armed forces for nearly 2 years. Elizabeth Fitzsimmons is the United States Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of African Affairs. She told VOA, "We have a democratically elected government in the Central African Republic. We have a military with a Minister of Defense at the head who is a woman. And I think that speaks volumes about the potential for cooperation between the United States and the Central African Republic." The United Nations praises the work of women as peacekeepers. It says female peacekeeping soldiers can help bring women in conflict areas into the peace process and give them a voice. Female peacekeepers can assist victims of sexual violence and protect children from violence in ways male soldiers cannot. In some cultures, only female peacekeepers can speak to women in need of aid. That has led to a higher number of women in civilian peacekeeping positions, but not in military peacekeeping operations. In the 7 active peacekeeping operations in Africa, women make up less than 4% of military personnel. Bintou Keita of Guinea is the UN's Assistant Secretary General for Peacekeeping Operations. She said, "The UN is working to achieve gender parity by the year 2030. Keita wrote, "Women peacekeepers act as role models in the local environment, inspiring women and girls in often male-dominated societies to push for their own rights and for participation in peace processes." Fatuma Ahmed is Kenya's first female major general. She told Kenya Citizen TV, "We have doctors, we have engineers, we have lawyers, we have jet pilots, we have pilots in air defense. We are spoiled for choice. This is just the beginning." I'm Jonathan Evans.
The popularity of winter clothing made with animal hair has greatly increased the demand for coyote fur. Coyotes are wild animals that are related to dogs and wolves. They are found in North America. Many people living in cold weather places around the world wear coats designed with furry edges that circle the head and neck. Many clothing companies use coyote fur from the United States to create these kinds of coats. Coyote fur is a favored choice because it is naturally full, soft, and has beautiful colors. A good coyote from the western United States is highly valued and can sell for at least $100. One top price at a recent sale in Colorado reached $170. That was up 40% from 4 years ago. John Hughes is a longtime buyer at J&M Furs in Roundup, Montana. He spoke to the Associated Press about the current demand for fur. Coyotes are hot, he said, and it's all due to the trim trade. The best time for trapping coyotes is in late fall and early winter, when coyote coats are at their fullest. But a lot of the selling happens in late winter. Much of the fur is sold at big auction houses in Canada. Local sales are also held in areas near where the animals are caught. One such auction was recently held in the small town of Herkimer, New York. People gathered in a local community center there to take part in the auction. Tables inside were filled with hundreds of furs from coyotes and other animals. The selection included muskrats, beavers, mink, fox, otters, and bobcats. Fur experts say the increase in demand for coyote fur started with coats made by Canadian clothing company Canada Goose. The coats are recognizable by the company's official design that shows the Arctic Circle. Canada Goose coats saw a big jump in sales in 2013. It happened after American model Kate Upton wore one of the company's coats over her swimsuit in a photo that appeared in the U.S. magazine Sports Illustrated. Over the years, more famous people and their fans have also chose to wear the fur-lined coats. Canada Goose coats can now sell for up to $1,000. Mark Downey heads Canada's Fur Harvesters Auction Company in North Bay, Ontario. Canada Goose is always the name that people relate to, he told the AP. But there are so many other brands that make similar coats. Downey said that most of these kinds of coats include coyote trim around the neck of the coat. Downey predicts the large demand for coyote fur will continue. Another seller is North American Fur Auctions, based in Toronto, Canada. In a statement published on its website in November, the company said the coyote trim business continues to be in full fashion, with Canada Goose being the major taker. The hot market for coyotes comes as trappers deal with recent economic downturns in both China and Russia. They also face competition from people raising animals for fur. In addition, animal rights activists call the trapping process cruel. I'm Brian Lynn.
And that's our program for today.
Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.